Many of you here this evening remember the original location of St. Pius V School. St. Pius V School was founded by the then Father Clarence Kelly in 1974. And from 1974 until 1998, the school rented a building that was owned by Christ Lutheran Church in Wantagh on the south shore of the island. Now, Bishop Kelly told me a very interesting story about a discussion that he had had with one of the ministers of Christ Lutheran Church. This particular Protestant minister was somewhat of a young man. One day he approached Father Kelly and he asked if he could speak to him. He was new there, and he wanted to know who we were and why we were doing what we did. And Bishop Kelly, of course, agreed to see him. And during the conversation, the bishop explained the Vatican II and the changes that occurred in the church, and especially in the Mass after the Council. And among the many changes in the Mass that the bishop mentioned to this Protestant minister was the change of the words of Christ in the form of the consecration of the wine. That is to say, the change of our Lord's own words for you and for many to the words for you and for all. Now, upon hearing this, the Protestant minister was shocked. He asked Bishop Kelly in so many words, how could such a thing be done? How could they change the words of Christ? And the minister wanted to know. The minister got up from his desk and went to his bookshelf to get his Lutheran Book of Worship, which contained their communion service. He began flipping through the pages until he found the page on which was printed the words of consecration. You see, many Protestant religions retain the use of the words of consecration in their services, but they did this not because they believe in transubstantiation or the holy sacrifice of the Mass, but because they were the words used by Christ at the Last Supper. The minister read the words, "For you and for many." Bishop Kelly then told him again that in the new Mass, these words were changed to "for you and for all." Bishop Kelly told me that the young Lutheran minister was really shocked. Since that time, however, I understand that certain Lutherans have changed their services to conform to the words in the new Mass. But up to that time, the modernists had gone further in their reformation of the Mass than even the Lutherans. In their boldness and audacity, the modernists dared to change the very words that were used by the Son of God himself when he instituted the holy sacrifice of the Mass at the Last Supper. They dare to change the very words whereby the wine is changed into the precious blood of Christ. My dear friends, as you know, this evening I would like to speak to you about the new Mass. And it is appropriate to deal with this subject on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of its official promulgation by Paul VI. Now, there is so much that could be said about the new Mass and the virtual universal destruction of the Catholic faith and morals in the wake of Vatican II. But this evening, I'm going to try, and I mean try, to limit my remarks to the subject of the new Mass, and conclude with what we priests, religious and faithful do and must continue to do in the face of this modernist reformation, which has proved in the last 40 years to be even more destructive than the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century. After my talk, if there are any questions, if anyone is still here, I would be happy to answer them as best I can. To begin then, on April the 6th, 1969, a decree was issued from the Sacred Congregation of Rites. The Sacred Congregation of Rites is one of the 15 Roman congregations or departments, if you will, that were created to help the Pope govern the Church. The Sacred Congregation of Rites was established by Sixtus V in the year 1588. And the purpose of this particular congregation was to protect and to oversee the rites prescribed by the Church for the celebration of the Mass and other ecclesiastical ceremonies and functions. But on April 6, 1969, the congregation decreed, and I quote, "The order of the Mass has been revised in accord with the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy and approved by Pope Paul VI in the Apostolic Constitution, Missalis Romani, dated April 3, 1969. By special mandate, the Sacred Congregation of Rites now promulgates this order of Mass and decrees that it take effect beginning November the 30th, 1969, the first Sunday of Advent." Unquote. The reference to the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy in the above quote is a reference to the Constitution Sacrosanctum Concilium, which was issued by the Second Vatican Council a few years before, and which plainly states that the rite of the Mass is to be revived. Now, it is very important that you understand something about modernists and the heresy of modernism, which was condemned by St. Pius X. And this is so because the modernists have been in control of virtually every Catholic institution, including the Vatican, since the early 1960s. First of all, it is important to understand that the so-called modernism did not begin with Vatican II. Pope St. Pius X had condemned it long before the Second Vatican Council. And he succeeded in purging modernism and the modernists from the Church to a very great extent, but he unfortunately died before his work was complete. Many of the modernists left the Church. Some were excommunicated, but many did not leave. And those who did not continued in their evil work and subversion of the Church in a much more subtle way. Like the efficient subversives that they were, they professed the faith openly, but they undermined it quietly and carefully. Many became seminary professors and won disciples to their cause as they waited for the right opportunity and indeed the right pope to come along. And Pope John the 23rd, with his liberal and modernist tendencies, proved to be their man. And Vatican II proved to be their opportunity. The original modernists who survived and their numerous disciples whom they trained came out into the open. For they had nothing to fear from John the 23rd, who shared their sentiments and who went so far as to publicly attack the good bishops and the cardinals in Rome who were opposed to Vatican II. You know, in his opening speech at Vatican II, John the 23rd attacked the enemies of modernism among the bishops and the cardinals. He actually called them prophets of doom. The ruthless rise of modernism and the control of all the important institutions of the church was at hand. And what John the 23rd began, Paul the 6th finished by his work of changing the Mass and the sacraments. You know, within 10 years of the opening of Vatican II, the church was in ruins. And the Mass was virtually gone. But how could such a thing happen in so short a time? The answer is the triumph of the greatest heresy in the history of the church. And that heresy is modernism, which contains in itself all other heresies. St. Pius X called it the synthesis of all heresy. And it is worse than all the heresies which had plagued the church from the very dawn of Christianity. And this is so because while past heresies attacked this doctrine or this teaching of the church, such as the heresy of Arius, of the 4th century attacked the divinity of Christ. Modernism is a heresy which attacks all doctrines and every aspect of the Catholic faith. It does this in many ways, but chief among these ways is its attack on human reason and its ability to know God from God's creation. In St. Paul's epistle to the Romans, chapter 1, the apostle says that man can know God from the fact of the creation of the world. By his reason, man can know God from creation. He actually says God is clearly seen by the things that are made. And if men do not believe, St. Paul says, they are inexcusable. Secondly, modernism denies all the true divine revelation. In other words, it denies that God intervened in human history to reveal objective and absolute truth through his incarnate Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, and his apostles. It denies all dogmas, that is, truths divinely revealed and infallibly taught by the church. And this attack upon the ability of human reason to know God through his creation and upon true divine revelation, it destroys all certitude with regard to our knowledge of God and the truths of revelation. In other words, it destroys the foundation of all truth. And it does this under the guise of being modern and relevant. And what does modernism substitute for divine truth? It substitutes a subjective religious feeling, which in the practical order, my dear friends, means absolutely nothing with regard to objective truth and morality. So you see, there is really nothing modern about modernism. The Catholic Church has always taught, it has always held, that the truths of the faith are divinely revealed. And thus, their content is immutable and it is unchangeable. But the modernist, whose goal is ultimately to change and destroy the Catholic faith, reject the teaching that truths come to us from God and are thus objective and immutable. And again, we see that the practical conclusion is that for modernism, there are no fixed and constant truths of the faith. Everything is relative. Everything is subjective. You've heard the saying, perhaps, what's true for you may not be true for me. But isn't this what we've seen in the last 40 years or so? Some Catholics, for example, have arrived at the quote-unquote truth that a person does not have to go to confession. Others have arrived at the quote-unquote truth that Christ is not really, truly, and substantially present in the Blessed Sacrament. Certain priests, such as Father Hans Kung, who is still recognized by the Vatican, the modernist Vatican, I should say, he is still recognized as a Catholic priest. And yet he denies the divinity of Christ and the perpetual virginity of the Blessed Virgin Mary. The effects on the clergy and laity as regards to faith and morals are everywhere to be seen. It really is no wonder that modernism is the most despicable and destructive heresy in the entire history of the church. Pope St. Pius X, in his encyclical letter against the modernist Pascendi, he said, and I quote, that the goal of modernism was to change the Catholic religion, unquote. He thus vehemently condemned it. And as I mentioned, he dealt it a severe blow and setback. But modernism survived, and it has reared its ugly head. Thus, we have noted modernism's attack upon man's ability to know God by reason and by revelation. We will now consider one of its practical means to bring about the destruction of the church. See, if you want to effectively change objective truths, if you want to objectively change objective dogmas, which people believe and hold sacred, you need a concrete means. And this means to the end they seek was and is the destruction of Catholic worship. The eminent theologian and liturgist, Father Nicholas Geer, wrote that there is no point of external life in which the truths of the faith are more directly and more distinctly revealed than in the liturgy of the church. There is no point, he said, of external life in which the truths of the faith are more directly and more distinctly revealed than in the liturgy of the church. And that is to say, the divinely revealed truths of our faith are clearly expressed in the rites and ceremonies of the church. This is proved in the words of Pope Saint Celestine I, who died in the year 432, and who said, "Legem credendi, lex statuit supplicandi," which in English means, "The law of praying sets the law of believing." The law of praying sets the law of believing. And what this means in the practical order is that the liturgical form of prayer becomes the standard of faith. And therefore, if you change the way people worship, you will change what they believe. You will change the standard of faith. You know, Martin Luther understood this. And he used his attack on the Mass during the Reformation of the 16th century to change the faith of the German people. And the modernists understood this as well. And so it was for many, many years the modernists targeted the holy sacrifice of the Mass. For the holy sacrifice of the Mass is the central act of Catholic devotion. It is a true sacrifice in the proper sense of the word. The priesthood of Christ are true priests with the power to offer sacrifice. Priests have the power to offer the sacrifice and to change bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. And thus, in the Holy Eucharist, our Lord Jesus Christ is really, truly, and substantially present in that consecrated host and truly offers himself to his eternal Father. The Mass is, therefore, the same sacrifice as that of the cross. The Council of Trent infallibly declared in the sacrifice of the Mass, Christ's sacrifice on the cross is made present. Its memory is celebrated and its saving power is applied. The sacrifice of the cross was offered in a bloody manner by a real separation of Christ's body and blood. In the Mass, however, it is offered in an unbloody manner by what we call a mystical separation, of the body and blood of Christ, accomplished by the double consecration. And thus, the Mass is the sacrifice of Calvary. It is the one and supreme sacrifice which has been offered for almost 2,000 years. So that individuals of every generation may effectively partake of the merits of Christ. St. Alphonsus de Liguori said that God himself cannot cause an action to be performed which is holier and grander than the Mass. If you understand this, and if you truly appreciate the holy sacrifice of the Mass, then you can understand why the devil and his modernist agents, those wolves in sheep's clothing, were so determined to destroy it and to substitute in its place the new rite of Mass. As one priest put it, the Roman Catholic Mass was thus long targeted by the modernists of the liturgical movement, who planned to reform the faith with the weapon of a reformed liturgy. It was in 1948 that a commission for liturgical reform was established in Rome. And the commission was headed by a Father Ferdinando Giuseppe Antonelli, a Franciscan priest who later became Cardinal Antonelli, and a Father Annibale Bugnini, who later became Archbishop Bugnini, the Archbishop of Tehran. And these were the two men who would eventually compose the new order of Mass: Ferdinando Antonelli and Annibale Bugnini. And thus, from its inception, from its very beginning, the liturgical commission had its eyes, so to speak, fixed on the Mass. The Mass would be radically changed, but first, the waters had to be tested. And this was so because the Mass instituted by Christ was loved and venerated for 2,000 years and was the center of Catholic life. Following the example of Martin Luther, a series of changes in the liturgical rites of the Church were made. This was done by the commission between 1950 and 1968. These changes began to be implemented by the 1950 changes in the Holy Saturday ceremonies and Mass. Then in 1955, changes in the entire rite of Holy Week, so that Holy Week was altered contrary to the most ancient practices of the Church. Then there were the various changes in the Roman breviary, the official prayer of the Church, that a priest is bound to daily pray under pain of mortal sin. Then there was the introduction of the Dialogue Mass in 1958, in which the lay people were encouraged and to begin to respond with the altar server during the Mass. And finally, in 1962, the Roman Missal of John the 23rd was introduced. Many changes were made in the Missal itself, as well as the universal calendar of the Church. The Confiteor, for example, the prayer of the Confiteor and the prayers of absolution before Holy Communion were abolished. But I think one of the boldest changes of the 1962 Mass of John the 23rd was to change the canon of the Mass, which had been untouched and unchanged since the time of Pope St. Gregory the Great, who died in the year 604. You know, this change was done under the pretext of honoring St. Joseph, for this change introduced his name into the canon of the Mass. But in truth, my dear friends, this change was not made to honor St. Joseph. It was made to use him to demonstrate that even the canon of the Mass, so ancient and so venerable, could be changed. And once they established this principle, that the unchangeable canon of the Mass could be changed, they were able to proceed even further. By the way, it is the 1962 Missal of John the 23rd, which is used for the so-called indult Masses, though now it is referred to as the extraordinary form of the Mass. It is also the rite of Mass officially used by the priests of the Society of St. Pius X. It's rather alarming, but also true, that the clergy of the Society of St. Pius X, who regard themselves as the true guardians of tradition and the last bastions of Catholicity, do not use the Missal of Pope Pius X. A saint, the archenemy of modernism and their own patron. Rather, they use the Missal of John the 23rd, who opened the windows and doors through which the poison of modernism entered the Church. In his opening speech to the Second Vatican Council, John the 23rd declared the need to update and make relevant all the dogmatic truths of our faith. And the results of what John the 23rd did were profoundly evil in their effects. His Reformed Mass, the Missal of 1962, was the bridge which would lead to the new Mass, which, as I have said, was promulgated on November the 30th, 1969. In fact, Father Annibale Bugnini, the architect of the new Mass, called the Missal of John the 23rd, and I quote, "the bridge which opens the way to a promising future," unquote. And this is the Mass used in the so-called extraordinary form in the indult Masses, as well as by the priests of the Society of St. Pius X. Now, while the new Mass was officially promulgated on that date, in the United States, however, it became official on Palm Sunday, March 22nd, 1970. The general instruction and the new order of Mass was issued to all the pastors in this country. This is a copy of the general instruction and the new order of Mass, of the new rubrics that would go into effect in this country March 22nd, 1970. According to some authors, the reason for the delay was to give the International Committee on English and the Liturgy time to prepare a common English translation of the new Latin Missal of Paul VI. Some of you here this evening, I'm sure, remember when this happened. My mother later mentioned a few things to me, for I was only 8 months old when the new Mass was promulgated. So you see, the new Mass wasn't the only thing that turned 40 this year. She told me on one particular Sunday at St. Catherine of Alexandria Church in Oak Lawn, Illinois, the south suburbs of Chicago, the whole Mass was in English. Priests faced the people, and the guitars and the tambourines had been brought into the sanctuary, and the banners and instruments were being played, and but she said many of the people in the pews became upset, and others even became angry. Even though by this time they were accustomed to change. But she said the priest offering the new Mass took notice of this. And my mother said that while the guitars and the tambourines were playing, he sang out as loud as he could, Dominus Vobiscum. And she said, the church shook as the people all cried out, Et cum spiritu tuo. It seems they were not quite ready. But eventually, as we know, the overwhelming majority of Catholic people were won over. Soon after the new Mass came in, my mother went to the pastor of St. Catherine of Alexandria Church, Father John Kane. And she said to him in so many words, Father, I cannot pray with all the noise and the talking. Want to know what Father Kane said to her? He said, gee, that's too bad. We made all these wonderful changes so that you could pray even better. Now, my mother would tell you herself that she did not know much about theology. But what she did know was that something was really wrong. Something terrible happened to the Mass, to the faith, and to the church. The Mass was radically changed, the faith was terribly altered, and the local church was not the same church in which she had been raised. No, the last straw for her was when a priest in the pulpit during his sermon held his fingers out. He held them together like this as the priest offering the true Mass holds them from the time of the consecration to communion. He held out his fingers and he said, these fingers were never meant to consecrate anything. That was it. I'm grateful to God that she had the sense of the true faith. For she began to seriously look for a priest who, as she said, still had the faith, still believed. We were very fortunate that she met a priest by the name of Father Leo McNamara on the south side of Chicago. This priest had never said the new Mass, but always offered the true Mass without any changes. Father McNamara was a very saintly priest. In fact, I understand as a seminarian, he studied at the North American College in Rome and actually had the great privilege of serving Pope St. Pius X's private Mass on a few occasions. He died in 1973, the year that the then Father Clarence Kelly began offering the Mass in a chapel constructed in his brother Pat's garage. But Father Leo McNamara offered the true Mass every Sunday until he could no longer offer Mass. He had nothing to do with the new Mass and the changes, and for this he was greatly despised. In fact, he still lived in the little apartment in the back of the church, which he had built while the priests of the new church were living in the brand new rectory, and they wanted nothing to do with him. But he lived in that apartment till he died. Among the last words he said to my mother was that she should have nothing to do with the new Mass and the changes. And then he said to her, never go over to them. And by them he meant the modernists. He actually said, no matter what happens, you can never go to the new Mass because the new Mass corrupts. And was he right? The overwhelming majority of Catholic people who went along with the changes have lost the faith because of the new Mass and the modernist doctrine. But by God's mercy, some have returned to the true Mass and to the true faith.